Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about diabetes. Now, I don't think it's news to you that we're in the midst of a diabetes epidemic, or more precisely, a diabesity epidemic. It's been estimated, and this is a big headline recently, that 50% of the U.S. population either already suffers from diabetes or suffers from pre-diabetes. So this is a huge problem. It's representative headline from the media recently. Diabetes could bankrupt the NHS, that's the National Health Service, socialized medicine in England, after a 60% rise in the number of cases. So this is a huge problem. And recently I came across a headline that caught my attention, something along these lines. Doctor to spend life savings placing ads to educate North Americans and Australians on diabetes crisis. So we tracked down that doctor. He is the impetus behind a website entitled Eat, Chew, Live. And we're going to talk to him today. He's Dr. John Putulil. He practiced medicine as a pediatrician and allergist for more than 30 years, primarily in the state of Texas. He received his medical degree from the University of Kerala in India, after which he did a medical residency in the U.S. and finally practiced here with full U.S. credentials. And during his medical practice, he became interested in understanding the causes of and interconnections between hunger and satiation and weight gain. And this became a personal passion. He's delved into this subject, and now he's on a personal crusade to get the word out about a more natural and fundamental approach to diabetes treatment and prevention. That's his mission statement on his website, Eat, Chew, Live. And so let's introduce today's guest, Dr. John Putulil. It's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
I thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for having me, and I also thank the listeners of Intelligent Medicine.
Well, yeah, it's our pleasure hearing from you. So, tell us a little bit about how you got so fired up about this.
Well, when I started gaining weight in early 50, at age around 50, early 50s, I asked three questions. One, why am I gaining weight even though I'm still exercising the same way and I'm eating the same amount of food? The second question I asked was, why is it that we don't always eat the same volume of food to feel satisfaction? Or what is the mechanism by which we feel satisfied?
That's the science of satiety.
Satiety, correct.
Right.
The third question I asked was, what happens to the nutrients that are absorbed after a meal before you eat again? And the third question led me to something very interesting. For example, all the nutrients are absorbed. They have to be processed within 4 hours by the liver and either stored or the cells have to use them. In the sense that the cells have picked up what they need, the leftover comes to the liver, the liver converts excess glucose, excess fatty acids, excess amino acids absorbed from the food for long-term storage. And it is very important to note that the liver can store only 120 grams of glucose as the long-term storage portion of carbohydrate called glycogen to be released back into the blood when your blood sugar goes down. All the rest, whether it is glucose or fatty acid or amino acid, will be converted into fat we call triglyceride to be stored in your fat cell. So, think about for a minute. You are sending this to a storage facility. Suppose the storage facility is completely full. Fat cannot be stored. So the fat will stay in the blood in the form of triglyceride. Anybody who has had a blood test will know there is a test for triglyceride, and
right.
Most people will not pay any attention to that because the doctors don't pay attention and tell them what that means.
Well, actually, many doctors will say, your triglycerides are a little high, but maybe you just ate. So, yeah, that's natural to have a high triglyceride. You know, so next time we'll do the test with a 12-hour fast, and, you know, then it'll be okay. But you think that there are more profound implications of those triglycerides that are floating around at levels of 150 or 200 or 300.
Well, what you have to do is to look at the trend. Anybody who has become diabetic, their triglyceride levels have been going up for months or even years prior to that. That is the tip off that why are the triglycerides going up in the blood? That is the first warning that you will get. What happens is when the triglyceride level goes up, the liver senses there is no point in converting the glucose or the fatty acid into triglyceride because the triglyceride is a fat that can stick to the inside of the blood vessels, just like cholesterol can. So if the liver does not convert the glucose into triglyceride, the glucose will stay in the blood and your blood sugar goes up. In addition to that, the fatty acids stay in the blood. Our muscles are like a hybrid engine, or the engine of a hybrid car that can use either electricity or gasoline to produce energy. Our muscles can use either glucose or fatty acid. If fatty acid levels are up in the blood, the fatty acid can walk into the muscle cell without help from insulin. So, if you are getting free fuel, why should you spend energy to acquire glucose? Muscles will start using fatty acid. Again, the glucose stays in the blood and it keeps going up, and you are diagnosed as pre-diabetic or diabetic.
Okay. And then, but in response to these high levels of blood sugar, your pancreas starts to go into overdrive, and that's why we get perhaps high insulin resistance.
Well, the word insulin resistance is very, very misleading. In fact, in my opinion, it is illogical, because what is the reason? We have 200 different types of cells in our body. Only three cell types become resistant: the liver, the fat, and muscle. Why? And the mechanism, nobody has explained the mechanism why the liver, or how the liver expresses the insulin resistance. All they know is it does something that is not supposed to be happening when insulin is around. When insulin is outside the liver cell, the liver has to do two things. One, it should not release glucose back into the blood. Second, the liver should produce triglyceride from the glucose. So if insulin and glucose are present outside the liver cell, the liver will crank up the triglyceride formation. If you take somebody who is a diabetic, yes, the liver cells are releasing glucose in the presence of insulin. So the experts will say, yeah, look at it. The liver cell is resistant to insulin. But what they ignore is the liver is also producing triglyceride, excess amount of triglyceride. So on the one hand, liver is actively responding to insulin. On the other hand, the interpretation is because glucose is being released, it is resistant, and the experts consider only the resistant part. Look at fat cells. Two things have to happen when insulin is outside a fat cell. One, the fat cell should not store fat. Second, it should not release fatty acid. Nobody has demonstrated fatty acids actually coming out of the fat cell. What they do is measure the blood for fatty acid level and say, oh, there are too much fatty acid in the blood. Therefore, they have concluded the fat cells are resistant. What I'm suggesting is fat cells are not resistant. There is excess fatty acid in the blood because the fat cells are too full of fat. They cannot accept any more fatty acids to reconstitute fat and store them. Now, look at the muscles. The muscles are thought to be resistant to insulin because muscles are not using glucose or even allowing the entry of glucose into the muscle.
Right. The analogy is water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. The diabetic seems to have high blood sugar, but it doesn't gain admittance to the cell where it can actually do energetic work. That's at least one of the theories behind type 2 diabetes.
That is the theory that we have been led to believe. But if that is the case, if the cell is not producing energy, how can a person with diabetes run and play and dance and do everything with their muscles because they need energy? In other words, those muscles, same muscles, are producing energy somehow. And if you look at a muscle that is at rest, glucose cannot get in without the help of insulin, because when insulin rings the bell, by the way, insulin never gets into the cell. It rings a bell on the receptor of the cell wall of the muscle, on the cell wall of the muscle. And the muscle cell or the cell has to send a transporter from the interior to the muscle wall, create a door for the glucose to enter into the transporter. Then only it will go in. A resting muscle cannot accept glucose without insulin. However, when the muscle is warm, when the muscle is active, it does not need insulin to accept glucose. And even diabetics, even muscles of diabetics accept glucose when they are exercising. So again, the same dichotomy there. The experts will look at the resting muscle and say, oh, this muscle is resistant. And it is even cynical in the sense that they will say, when you are exercising, your muscles become more sensitive to insulin.
Right. Yeah, that's actually one of the ways to overcome type 2 diabetes is to be on a concerted exercise program or to build additional muscle.
Well, they say that the exercise is beneficial because the muscles become more sensitive to insulin during exercise. What I'm suggesting is when muscles are exercising, they don't need insulin's help. So how can you become more sensitive to something you don't need?
Right. So they will actually accept either the fuel, either glucose or free fatty acids, as energy sources.
Correct. So if there are fatty acids are available entering the muscle, because the muscle wall is made of fatty acid. Fatty acids can wiggle in. They don't need any help from insulin.
Right.
So that is free for the muscles to use. Why should they accept all glucose? And the experts interpret this as insulin resistance, which is, to me, completely wrong.
Well, what are the practical implications of rethinking our approach to type 2 diabetes in terms of all the medications we use, sometimes more or less successfully, but also in terms of our current dietary approach to type 2 diabetes?
Well, let us take the medications and use the word successfully. How do you measure success of a treatment? In type 2 diabetes, the fallacy is we measure success by reducing the blood sugar.
Right. That's the metric. That's the benchmark of success. We get the hemoglobin A1C down, or we get the fasting glucose down, and we think, okay, we're fixing the patient.
And that is the primary problem, because the same people who have normal blood sugar or normal A1C for years, they suffer exactly the same complications as those who don't have the blood sugar under control.
Well, that is a little revolutionary, because a viewpoint like that could get you in trouble with the medical establishment, couldn't it?
Well, you can look at anybody who is on insulin, and how many of them avoid complications? Mm-hmm. You tell me.
No, I agree.
Right.
I think I know where you're going with this, is that I think the proper endpoint is not whether we lower a person's blood sugar. We can do that with any number of medications, but whether people, A, live longer, whether they, B, avoid heart attacks and strokes and other complications of diabetes.
Absolutely. That is where I'm going, in the sense, suppose you give somebody insulin, their blood sugar, that person's blood sugar drops. Where does that sugar go? Does it get out of the body? No. The insulin will instruct the liver cells to convert that glucose into triglyceride. The liver cell is one of the most sensitive cells in the body to insulin. The liver will happily convert, or will be forced to convert, excess glucose into fat. And that fat is accumulating in the body. That fat, there is no outlet for fat from the body. Sugar, being water soluble, can go out through the kidney, but fat cannot. So this is why, in spite of keeping blood sugar A1C level normal, I can show you people who have kept diligently their A1C level before 7, got their toe amputated because of blockage. How can that happen?
For our listening audience, I think we distinguish between the type 1 diabetes, where maybe early in youth, teenage, people have pancreatic failure. The islet cells don't produce insulin. They do need insulin. We're talking about the majority of diabetics, perhaps 90% of diabetics who acquire it, earlier and earlier, unfortunately. You're a pediatrician. You probably saw kids developing type 2 diabetes. But what used to be referred to as adult onset diabetes is associated with overweight, overeating, sedentary lifestyle.
That is correct, and you correctly pointed that, and I'm glad you mentioned that we are not talking about type 1, even though there are type 1 diabetics being diagnosed in younger adults now, either because their pancreatic cells are destroyed by a virus or some other reason. Yes,
right, autoimmunity, perhaps, yeah.
Correct. They do need insulin for survival. There is no question about that. That reminds me, I had one person who I asked to, who read my manuscript before it was published as a book.
That's Eat, You Live.
Correct, Eat, You Live. And he followed what I instructed him to do. He lost weight. He was on insulin. He was on 3 other medications for his type 2 diabetes, which was diagnosed about 10 years prior to that, and he lost weight. He started reducing his insulin dosage, and he stopped insulin. Within a week, he ended up in the emergency room in ketoacidosis.
Right.
Ketoacidosis is a condition that is experienced by type 1 diabetics.
Right.
In other words, this person, he started his diabetes mid-20s. He was a type 1 to begin with, but because we don't have a test for insulin resistance, his doctors assumed he was a type 2, and he was treated as a type 2 for 10 years. Now, how many others are there like that because we don't have a test for insulin resistance?
So in other words, this has to the approach that you advocate in Eat You Live has to be applied selectively to patients who have prediabetes, the type 2 diabetes. That would be a different population than the people who are reliant on insulin. I get that. So what are the practical implications? What do you advocate in Eat You Live?
Well, in any, you mentioned at the beginning of our talk the cost factor, the tremendous amount of money we have to spend, and Medicare is going to go bankrupt. NIH will not have the money to do anything except to treat, or even to treat all the diabetics that are going to be coming online. The only way we can save substantial amounts of money in treating any health condition is to prevent it. Otherwise, there is no way we can treat all the people who are going to be coming on board with the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. In order to prevent a condition, we need to establish the cause. So you may have to ask ourselves, people around the globe, are they evolving to become insulin resistant? Why insulin? Why should the body suddenly decide to become resistant to one of its own natural hormones? Even then, why only 3 cells out of 200 types in the body? How do they decide, and who starts it, and how does it spread from one organ to another, and how does it spread from one country to another? This is not an infectious disease.
Right. So what's the common denominator? What is the common denominator that
exactly.
is causal here?
Right. So that is what we have to determine first. The insulin resistance theory has been around for over 80 years. Yet, if we do not know why it happens, what is the mechanism, we don't even have a test to say, okay, you are mildly resistant, moderately resistant, highly resistant. If a medication does not work, is it because you have become more resistant? How do we know? They say, well, for whatever reason, your medication is not working, we need to change it, or we need to put you on insulin. And we know insulin works. How? Because your blood sugar is down, not because you can measure your resistance and say, okay, if you take insulin, your blood resistance to insulin will go down. That brings an interesting paradox. You are supposed to be resistant to insulin, and what are you given as treatment?
You're given the very self-same thing that you supposedly don't do well with. Yeah, I get it. So, okay, we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. So what I would like you to do in part two, and we will rejoin you in just a moment, is let's trace the dietary implications of this. And
yes.
In your book, Eat You Live, you issue a clarion call for people to undertake a preventive approach, a more naturally based approach to diabetes.
Right.
And that's what we're going to tackle in part two. Okay. Our guest is Dr. John Poutouliel, who has embarked on his own personal crusade to educate North Americans and Australians on the diabetes crisis. And he's got some novel views on the science, and in a moment we'll explore the implications. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.